A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Hey, what is going on that you guys felt like the need to put this kind of pathology on film?
No kidding, right? What's going on in there?
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Scher.
Yo!
From a lot of things. Yeah. All the things, maybe. Yes. Yeah, all the things. All the things. And we will be doing a mini-pod.
Mini-pod!
Of Uncut Gems today. This movie has... It's interesting in so many ways. It's the way it's being received. It's one of those rare movies that critics love and audiences have, for by and large, don't like.
Yeah. Yeah. I was surprised. I don't know if I'm surprised by anything these days, but that is a big disparity.
It's like what I remember with The Vavitch.
Was that the same?
Yes. The critical reception for that was, I think, above 90% on Rotten Tomatoes for critics. And people, by and large, didn't like it. And I think it got like one of those C-minus cinema scores, maybe even D.
Oh, really?
Somewhere around there.
Wow.
This one, I think this one got a C cinema score. And the Rotten Tomatoes audience score is somewhere around 50.
Yeah, 52.
52%. So it's an interesting thing. Now... It's an interesting thing because I knew that going in to watch this, that audiences were not liking it for some reason and that critics were loving it. And a lot of times I'm on the audience's side. This time I'm not on the audience's side.
You're on the critic's side.
I'm on the critic's side. I know that you're on the audience's side.
I'm below the audience.
You're below the audience.
Way below.
Okay. I'm going to be interested. I'm going to be interested to hear what your criticisms of this movie are and what I might have to say in response to it. Because, like, the stuff that when I was watching this, I was like, okay, I should hate this and I should hate this. Why am I enjoying myself? And I can't figure out exactly why this is. And then in the end, I came at peace with a decision about why I was enjoying the movie and everything. And I'm just interested to know why you did not like it.
It's fascinating because I had the exact opposite response in that this is all stuff that's right up my alley. Like the hyperkinetic heisty aspects of this type of thing, even though it's not a traditional heist. I've been... probably among our regular Sincast, probably the biggest Adam Sandler apologist here. I like the Mr. Deeds. I even like the anger management and stuff like that. Of course, that's more on his comedic side. But largely the praise for this film is because of his performance and that his likability as an actor is what makes his character palatable. And to me, it was not palatable at all. I think I honestly need... therapy about this movie because I swear to God, I was thinking the exact same thing. It was like, man, this is like really gritty and like really hyperkinetic, filmed really beautifully. The performances are great. Like there's some really good stuff to like here. I loved the score, even though the score is part of what is so disorienting. For some reason, by the end of it, I was just like, God damn, I hate this movie. I recognize that it's extremely well done. And I totally understand why people love it. I just hated it. Just viscerally, mm-hmm. I hated it. Mm-hmm. And I have some reasons why.
Though. Yeah. I understand. This is Anxiety the movie, right?
It is. It is.
And I was struggling with myself to figure out if this is something that is something that to be lauded, like it. They do such a good job doing it. They're obviously trying to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
The question becomes, is that good? Because, rising anxiety watching a movie is not the most fun place to be in.
Mm-mm.
And there's a scene in this movie. There's several scenes, but there's one in particular where it just feels like everything is happening all at once.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how does anybody deal with all this? And ultimately I went on the side of, I think this is good. I think this is something that they wanted to do. They accomplished it and it works for the film, but I don't like feeling that way.
No, I understand. I agree with you. I think everybody agrees that this is the movie that the directors wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
The Safdie brothers.
I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think that's probably right.
It seems like, I mean, yeah, you're right. This is very purposeful. Like I said, the score is really, really good, but the score added with the dialogue, and this is not a spoiler, but one scene, I don't know if it's the scene that you're talking about, is in the jewelry shop
mm-hmm.
where everybody is talking at the same fucking time.
Probably it.
And the score is going in this crazy, like almost mm-hmm. psychedelic type of way,
mm-hmm.
and this is when my wife and I were watching it on a date night, and this is when we turned to each other, we were like, this is so stressful,
mm-hmm.
and I actually at the time, because we were in the back, I didn't know if we were getting like one speaker too much or something like that,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's supposed to be that way, to where by the end of it you're just like, I don't even know what's going on really right now,
mm-hmm.
it's so chaotic and it's so anxiety inducing that to me it was distracting. Now I kind of knew this ahead of time, like this is going to be a stressful movie, that kind of thing, this is going to be something that's always moving and that kind of thing. I was not expecting my physical reaction to this movie. I really felt like I was having an anxiety attack the entire time.
Yeah, and that's sort of the rub, right? This movie makes you feel this way.
Yeah, and that is my main problem. That I'll get into spoilers later on with it, but that itself with the coda is my main issue with this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and grade it and then get into spoilers then. What would you grade this movie?
Because it's so well made, and there's one part in particular that I'll talk about later on that is, I really felt personally.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't go below like a C, because below a C is like saying, oh, well, this movie's trash. This movie's not worth my time. This movie's worth my time. I just didn't enjoy it at all. So my it's weird because my personal feeling would put it as an F. My sensible opinion would put it no less than a C, but mm-hmm. I would put it as a C.
Yeah. I'm putting this as an A.
Mm.
And it's really like, I really did not expect to be that high on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really didn't. Yeah. I went into this just kind of going, I have been in movies like this before. I know exactly what, I mean, it's going to be one of those where, you know, there's a whole bunch of expectation from the trailer that they've set up. And then you're going to go in and you're going to be like, oh, so this is the movie, huh? And I didn't feel that the whole time. So, I like this a lot better than I thought I would.
I'll tell you one thing before we get into spoilers, because this is maybe something that would get people interested in watching it. The performances, even outside of Adam Sandler, for what the character is very, very good. You could even say spectacular mm-hmm. in this role. But the other players are fantastic. Kevin Garnett is really, really good in this. Lakeith Stanfield, I wish he would have been given more, like we always want for Lakeith Stanfield, but mm-hmm. he's really good in this. I love Judd Hirsch in this movie because I rarely see Judd Hirsch outside of like the bumbling old man mm-hmm. Independence Day type of thing. He's spectacular in this.
Yep.
Eric Bogosian is fantastic.
Yeah.
Idina Menzel.
Yeah.
Is glorious in this movie.
That's another thing about this movie is that the casting is just like, it's on the surface offbeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you're like, wow, these people are wonderful in this particular role, this particular movie. Like, I wish more, I don't know if more movies can do this kind of thing.
Right.
But like, there are a lot of actors in here who don't have very many credits. There are very big roles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a guy in here who plays one of Eric Bogosian's heavies who's like, it's his only role.
Keith Williams Richards.
Yeah, yeah, that's that guy.
Yeah, and he's spectacular.
He's great in it. And I kept thinking, where have I seen this guy
I know,
before?
Me too.
I've seen this dude, and I haven't.
I thought the same thing about Julia Fox, who plays a very, very important character. I got very strong Ana de Armas vibes from her.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially given her role, similar to what her Ana de Armas' role in Blade Runner 2049 was.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more there, and God, she spans the spectrum of emotions in her performance.
Yet another actress that comes in, and you're like, okay, they hired her because she's pretty, and mm-hmm. she's just doing that cute role. And then by the end of it, you're like, holy shit, she's great in this.
I know. Yeah. So, I mean, as low as I am on this movie personally, objectively, the performances are dynamite. The score is dynamite for what it is. I'd love to listen to it on its own, actually. Mm-hmm. I bet it's like nice and calm and peaceful on its own.
Yeah.
But I actually, despite my feelings, I would encourage people to see this movie. I would encourage people to see this movie in the theater, if mm-hmm. possible, because it certainly is a specific type of cinema that is best experienced in that environment.
Yeah, for sure. I was in a fairly packed house, and I had my own like sort of anxiety issues due to the projection.
Oh, well, really?
Because I'll get into that later. I won't get into that into this podcast, but that gives me anxiety, and I hate going out and complaining about it because mm-hmm. then I have to explain how I know something's fucked up when they're telling me something's not. So there was that. And then, you know, it was a late night crowd mm-hmm. and it was like, oh no, are we going to have this kind of like, you know, people talking through them? It was like actually pretty silent through the movie. So anyway, let's go on to spoilers on this thing.
Let's do it.
Kevin Spacey is Kaiser Soze.
He's Luke's father is actually Darth Vader. She's the sister and the daughter. They just
No. I'm reading the books.
Because this is a movie that you need to really get down and dirty with and everything.
It's a dirty movie.
At first, it's easy to say, I hate this Howard Ratner guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandler is such a like he plays it so well because it's like, this is the type of guy that you do not ever want to run into your life ever.
Yeah.
You've seen these guys before. They're very positive about everything, but they're fucking losers.
Yes.
And I can understand an audience watching this and going, this guy is not redeemable. He's an awful person. He does awful things all the way through this. Every time he's about to get out of this situation he's in, he goes and fucking gambles the money away and something else happens, you know? And so it's hard to understand because a lot of us don't run into people like this and everything.
Yeah.
But these people are very, very, they very much exist.
Oh, yes.
And I'm, you know, as a guy who plays a lot of poker, I have run into not these people, but I've run into people who's sort of like the guy behind the guy who is that guy and everything. And so like I've heard stories of people like this who are just like they just don't. The gamble is the thing that they live for, mm-hmm. man. They don't care about their life. They don't care about money, nothing.
Yeah.
And so you look at a guy like this and you're like, oh, what a terrible person. I can't root for this person. And then still there's a magic trick by the end of it when he's got Bogosian and his two guys like locked up in that little like outside office, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
whatever. And they're like burning to death, essentially. Like they can hear them. You can see them sweating back there and everything. Like, you're like actually going, oh my God, this Celtics game. Look at Garnett go and all that. And you're like, for a minute there, you're like, yeah, this guy, man, this guy's going to win. He's going to do the thing that we want him to do.
Mm.
And they still managed to pull that off a little bit.
I understand that, and I totally understand that. I to me, this guy makes so many conscious mistakes outside of gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that's part of the pathology. But to me, this guy is not redeemable at all.
Mm-hmm.
Again, love Adam Sandler as an actor, typically. But to me, he didn't make this character palatable at all to me. I was rooting for him to get shot in the fucking head at the end of this.
But does the movie pull its punch if he does have redeemable qualities? What redeemable qualities should he have in this that makes him a character that we want to succeed by the end of it?
You know, I mean, far be it for me to you know, reshuffle the character traits or anything like that. But if the movie does do a good job of showing us little things before they happen, you know, foreshadowing, that kind of thing. If the only moment that he really has where you can point to and say, like, I think I may have something inside that's a decent guy, is at the Passover Seder. And that was my favorite scene by far. Mm-hmm. It's really the only time that you can catch your breath in this entire
movie.
Yeah,
for sure.
And that was brilliant because he's still hustling, but he's actually like genuinely talking to his father-in-law, Judd Hirsch, and he's talking to his kids and everything. He, you know, there's a little bit of a break in the facade, but then he goes in to talk to his current wife, about to be ex-wife, and his pitch to her is such a fucking grift. It's such a fucking grift. It's forgive me for everything, even though I'm not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is where they're saying, well, you know, maybe you can feel for this guy and everything. I did not. I was like, no, I was laughing in his face just like she was.
Mm-hmm.
And what a great performance that she did. She was like, your face. I hate your face.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, yes, I agree.
But this is the rub for me, and this is why I ended up being on the other side of this and saying that I loved it. We go into movies all the time rooting on a hero because that's what we're told we need to have when we watch a movie. We have to have a guy that we, or a woman that we can, like, we can root for, because otherwise then we just sort of just want him to die or whatever. But like, I was sitting there going, this is a different thing. They want you to, it's fine if you hate this guy. It's mm-hmm. fine if you think it's cool that he gets shot in the face at the end. It's totally fine for you to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I've ended up saying this is the movie they wanted to make. They didn't want this. They didn't care about this guy being redeemable. They wanted him to be like a guy that they've probably run into before or they've heard about or something like that. And I think a lot of times we go into movies, we feel like we need to have these certain set of criteria met in a character before we say, all right, I like this movie. And this is one where they're doing something different.
It absolutely is. Absolutely. I'm just, you know, I'm absolutely good with everything that you just said, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, watching a character throughout the movie. There's no growth, there's no arc for me for this character, and there's no payoff. And I want to just briefly compare this movie to Whiplash.
Mm-hmm.
Whiplash is another what people call very anxiety inducing movie.
For sure.
And you really end up, I guess you root for the Miles Teller character because, you know, he's done so much, but he's also not been a perfect guy. I mean,
nope.
He cuts off his girlfriend, all that stuff. And you certainly don't want to root for J.K. Simmons' character.
Yeah.
End of that movie is hard to watch at times, but also has a spectacular payoff.
Mm-hmm.
There's no payoff in this movie for me. There's no growth. There's no, like, even him winning that. It's like, you don't deserve to win that. You fucked up everything in order for that to materialize.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this is where the movie gets credit for foreshadowing. You don't see a gun until right at the end where dude flashes it when he's in that bulletproof mm-hmm. thing. And then I just knew, you know, he's sitting there. He's a fucking ticking timer.
Oh,
as
yeah.
soon as he gets out of there, what choice does he have?
Dude, seriously, that honestly, I've never seen that to me was the payoff.
I totally understand that.
You know what I'm saying?
I totally understand that. Yes.
Because this guy has been following Eric Bogosian's rule this whole time. He's like, you know, basically telling this guy, you better bring us the money, you better give us the money, and never being allowed to do anything. It's like tantric violence, essentially. Never being able to do anything to the guy other than like maybe punch him a couple of times. Now this guy has the fucking nerve to trap them behind this bulletproof thing. In this hot, this is what the movie does so well. Bogosian, you see his shirt, and he's like just matted in sweat. And this guy has been sitting there going, I've wanted to kill this motherfucker since I first ran into him. And now he has the gall. I don't give a fuck if he even gets the money. I'm killing this motherfucker as soon as he lets me out. And I kept going. I was like, this guy is so fucking stupid. There's no way I would let these guys back in.
No.
After that.
No.
There's no fucking way.
And he's so delusional. He's like, okay, everything's good, right?
Doesn't care about his life. Doesn't care about the money. No. Doesn't care. He's so on a high about winning that thing. This is actually his perfect death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This is his perfect death. This is the best way he can go out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this is where the conflict is for people who are watching this movie. Whether or not you're on board with that kind of character and what happens to him and whatever, like, is this somebody that we need to be redeemed? I never thought that he needed to be redeemed. I thought it was exciting watching that bet, though, unfold. Especially, what's that?
That was exciting?
No, yeah, it was. Because I was sitting there going, here's the complex thing about it, is that while you're excited, you know he's going to die. You know, and if you're watching, carefully, you know he's not going to, this isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it, one way or the other, either he wrote the wrong thing down on the post-it note, which is something that I thought might have happened, where he went over there and gave, and had to go through all this stuff to give his girlfriend the thing, and she goes out to the Mohegan Sun and puts this bag down and is like, yeah, follow the post-it note. Exactly. I thought, man, you know what it is? There's gonna be a misreading of that post-it note, and he's gonna think it may even be a thing where they're playing on that expectation.
Well, yeah, you've been primed to, because he won that previous bet.
Yeah.
And he got submarined by fucking Eric Bogosian's character where he canceled the bet.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh no, everything's fine, I got it all. You canceled the fucking bet. So yeah, you're primed to think something is going wrong with this.
Yeah, so even while you are sitting there, and if you're an astute viewer, you know that there's no way he's going to get this $1.2
million.
Mm. It's exciting to watch that go through, and it's exciting for me to watch this to go through, and like, he's actually getting it and everything. But you're still in the back of your head, you know something's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's still fun to watch the guy actually like get this, like, bet this insane parlay to go through, because it's like, there's something about it. You're like, okay, maybe this will be, I don't think he's going to get through this, but
it is an insane parlay, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous bet.
Well, there's that, Garnett's got to win the opening tip, which is a funny, hilarious thing. He's like, because at the beginning, Garnett wins the tip, and it's like, and Sandler's like, oh my God, I'm glad he got that. Oh, that could have ruined the whole thing. and then he's got to have a combined points and rebounds of 26, and the Celtics have to win the game,
right?
So the tip is maybe the most insane thing. That's just 50-50 out of that whole thing. The other stuff, you're like, okay, that makes a little bit more sense, even though you still could easily lose that $120,000+
you
just put up. So watching it is exhilarating, but you're also, like I said, you know there's no way he's getting away with this.
Yeah. To me, that scene was two things I want to mention about that scene. That scene to me was excruciating instead of exhilarating, because I've seen that guy do that, not particularly with a bet, but the guy who hangs on every play and is talking about it and is getting way too excited about everything and then fucking like punching the TV and shit like that. To me, like, I guess I've seen it so much, I've probably done it myself, annoyingly, that I didn't want to watch it. I was just like, okay, can we just get it over with. Not to mention, I had seen that game before too, so you know, I didn't know how many points Kevin Garnett had, but I knew that the Celtics were going to win. So like the the resolution wasn't really like in doubt for me and everything. It was just like, oh, just watching this guy do this. Again, great performance. He does it perfectly, mm-hmm. but I've just seen it before. The second thing is, this is basically implying that the NBA is corrupt with betting lines, right? Because Garnett sees all that shit before he goes out and does all this shit.
Yeah, and I don't think that's anything that many people are going to argue. I mean, NBA has done that to themselves. Yeah. They had that Donaghy scandal mm-hmm. a long time ago, and still people are like, well, that's the guy who got caught. Now we're still running. We still have this shit happening, but people aren't getting caught.
It's just interesting to say the movie is saying this outcome was at least partially influenced by one of the star players knowing what the line was.
Well, and apparently Kevin Garnett signed off on that shit because he's playing himself.
So, I mean, that was an interesting part of it, but it was also like, you know, maybe we could lean into that a little harder too. So, but I totally understand being exhilarated by that last scene, but man, it was just like nails on a chalkboard for me.
Yeah. I think it comes down to whether or not you are down with this unlikable character mm-hmm. the entire time. They never once, I don't think they ever once want you to root for this guy necessarily.
Yeah.
I think it is shocking to most people that he gets shot, even though if you've been paying attention, yeah. I mean, there's no way. There's just no way. I mean, I was like, especially as soon as he's like, took that file out and let them in. I was like, oh, you motherfucker.
What was surprising to me was that his brother-in-law, the Eric Bogosian character, kept at it.
Yeah.
Kept at it. Like, he knows what the stakes are here, man. Mm-hmm. Shut your fucking mouth.
Yeah.
And so I did not expect him, because I assume he's a well-connected dude and that kind of thing, for this dude to, he's just at the end of his rope, this henchman. He's like, fuck you.
Well, that's the thing, too. I think that Bogosian is a guy who has been used to being in power in a lot of powerful situations, and he thinks there's no way somebody has the balls to shoot him at this point and everything. And so, like, he's delusional as well in this whole thing, because he's never understood the psychology of these people that he's hiring to help him out and everything. You can't treat them like he's basically just saying, you know, are you a full-time gangster or not? That's what these people are about, you know? And it's like, let's get into some other things about this. The anxiety, the movie part.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously this character Howard like owes everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a scene where there's a guy trying to get this like Michael Jackson on a cross thing back. There's another guy who I guess he sold a fake Rolex to.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this is another audience expectation thing. I thought one of those guys might end up killing him.
You're talking about the shorter guys with like the Simon Garfunkel afro type of thing.
Yeah. There was one guy who keeps coming back trying to get $32,000, but the other guy was trying to get his Michael Jackson on a cross. It's got diamond, it's like diamond encrusted Michael Jackson on a cross or something like that.
Yeah, because he's loaned all this shit. Lakeith Stanfield gives him all these watches. All those fucking watches are gone, man.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Like, he has just loaned all this stuff out. There's like all the stuff when Kevin Garnett comes and wants that opal rock or whatever.
Mm.
And he gives him the championship ring as collateral. Then he goes over and like hawks it for
immediately
for like $20,000+ dollars. And then there's Vig running on it.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, once I win this bet, then I'll just pay him plus the Vig and I'm good.
Which he would have been at that point, right?
Yes.
If that bet goes through, can't say that the rest of the movie doesn't happen, but still.
They never, the rest of the movie. Well, again, it could be one of those things where he gets that money and then he bets that money on.
Right, of
you
course.
Know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
He could have done it that way too. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much he stood to win with that bet at the beginning.
I think it was somewhere around 100,000 to where it would get him like, not even with everybody, but even with the mobster guys.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was like a six-way parlay with $12,000, and I don't know exactly how much that was supposed to get. But yeah, he owes Bogosian $100, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then he owes he's going to owe the jeweler guy $20,000+, and then, you know, who else knows? Other people he doesn't care about Other people, he's just like, whatever. They'll always owe, probably.
And plus, in his back pocket, he's got this uncut gem that he thinks is worth millions of dollars.
He does. He thinks that there's 3,000 carats and there's going to be 1,000 a carat that he's going to get. It's another one of those things where you're like, you know that opal is not going to fetch the money he thinks it's going to.
I actually kind of went with the movie with that one. I was like, well, probably so. I mean, because the first scene sets up how dangerous it is to get this shit and how rare this mineral is. Mm-hmm. So I was like, maybe it is. And that was a very cool whammy that the movie throws at you, is where the auction house is like 125 or whatever it is. And yeah, that's where you really see the whole range of emotions with this dude, that he's like shock, anger, sadness, despair. I'm fucked.
Yeah. You just realize early on this guy is just a loser and he doesn't, he never will get that. There's certain aspects to these characters where even when they do something right, something is going to happen that's going to screw all that up. Mm-hmm. Like the bet that happens and then Bogosian stops it. You know, everything that he does, Garnett gives him that ring as collateral, and I thought for a moment there Garnett was just never going to bring that thing back.
Yeah, me too.
Because it just felt like, and he even says later on, it's like, I didn't even have to bring it back and all that. And so it got to the point where I was like, this opal, and when Garnett said, I'll give you $250,000 for it. I was like, that's where he should have taken it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I was like, there, I guarantee you this opal is less once he puts it to the auction. And sure enough, they start the bidding at like 40,000 or something. So, and it teeters at 100. And then thankfully he's got Judd Hirsch to help him out to move up the price.
He massively screws, man.
Yeah, exactly. And he thinks he's going to get it up to that 200 and something price. And Garnett's got his financial advisor with him.
And it's just that's a really tense moment of a movie with tense moments, because it's at 190. And you're like, there's no way he's not going to go for the round number. Like, that's my hard limit. But no.
Yeah. 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 So yeah, the anxiety part is, the real anxiety part is in that jewelry store when everybody is hitting him up. Everybody. And there's like just little things that just like the door won't open. Mm-hmm. The people inside that little thing are getting pissed off at him, and there's nothing he can do about it.
And that's Garnett is in there.
Garnett,
right?
Yeah. And then there you have another guy outside who wants his money, and it's just a constant like thing going on there.
And then in the middle of it, he calls his colonoscopy doctor.
Oh yeah, yeah.
On speaker.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got Lakeith Stanfield yelling at him about the watches, and he's just like, "Oh, well, that's really good. You didn't find anything. Great. All right."
And that's probably there's probably some sort of symbolism in the fact that one of the first shots of the movie after the whole African mind thing is a colonoscopy. This has something to do with this. We are in the ass end of whatever, that type of thing. But yeah, again, it's all going to come down to whether or not you are ready to like a movie with a character that's this unlikable. They tried to do this stuff before. I remember in the movie, it's Payback. Mel Gibson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mel Gibson is like an absolute asshole and everything, but all the other people are bigger assholes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how he's a nice guy, a protagonist in the movie and everything. They try this a lot of times. This one didn't really, I don't think it really sold itself as, here's a character that you're not going to like, and he's never going to be likable, and you're going to have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. No. Because I don't think anybody would willingly go to see a movie like, not anybody, but a lot of people would want to go see a movie like that.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting to know if I knew that, but going in, would I have been more apprehensive about watching it?
Mm-hmm.
In the end I was sold on it. I was sold on what they were doing there. The Safdie brothers also did a movie called Good Time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen this.
That's Robert Pattinson, right?
Pattinson.
That's on the list to see.
Yeah, Robert Pattinson's in it. Pattinson is a character in that movie who you think has maybe some redeemable qualities, but it just feels like he's always on the precipice of, like, he's about to get there, he's about to get there, and then something happens. And that movie has a lot, it doesn't have as much anxiety as this movie does, but there is at least one scene where there's like a couple of phone calls going back and forth between four characters. And it's got that same ratchet up type of thing where the person on the other end of the line is hysterical and doesn't want to, you know, it doesn't know what to say to them or is giving them information they don't want to hear. And then another phone call over here, which could change that phone call, is happening. You know, it's you're just like, God damn, guys, what is going on that you guys felt like the need to put this kind of pathology on film?
I'm kidding, right? What's going on in there? Yeah. And there's two of them.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, a divergent look there at Uncut Gems.
Can I ask you a question specifically, though?
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with Julia Fox's character? When we first see her, there's a bunch of what look like prostitutes running in and out of the apartment.
Right.
And he's acknowledging, he's like, I must have had a party last night or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then she's dealing coke to the weekend.
Yeah.
But she's also working at the jewelry shop, but also doesn't come to work.
Yeah, this is something that I wasn't quite sure about.
Yeah.
Because when we first see her, we're like, what is her relationship to him? There's another woman in the bed.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I know all you want to do is just come over and snuggle or whatever. And this is after he's been yelling at her for a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I don't know. Oh, she works there. Oh, okay. She works with him. And then I got the impression of with the thing with the weekend is that she's just a hot chick and that she's someone that the weekend would pull out of an audience and be like, come party with me and everything. And that's how she got into that room.
I thought he had mentioned when he's berating her, when he's trying to get to the cab, I thought he mentioned that she was dealing again or something like that. So like there's so many different things because she's making this look like a transaction for the weekend. Who, by the way, it's funny. I know this because I've worked weekend videos before, but like the credits came up at the beginning with Abel Tesfaye.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, who the I recognize that name. That's the Weeknd's real name.
Oh,
that's right. But yeah, so in the bathroom, she makes it look transactional. She gives him the drug. She does a little bit, and he's trying to get in. She's like, nope, no touching.
But he's like able to sort of seduce. Like he's getting close.
Like, touch it. And she's like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's like, how are you this hard already? and stuff like that. And it could be where she gets to a point, just a like – crosses the line but not like completely over the line or anything where she kind of like makes people think that they're gonna get to have sex with her or something like that. I don't know. I didn't understand why she was in love with him, Howard, so much.
You're not kidding. That I didn't understand that at all. Fuck out. And what's crazy is another thing that the movie does very, very well is show the tattoo before all the shit goes down, because before that you could say that maybe she's just using him for his money or for that nice apartment in Manhattan or whatever, or access, and you know, that kind of thing. But when she gets that tattoo, you're like, she's actually in fucking love with him.
Yeah.
And she's taking care of him. So you know, or at least I know, she wasn't going to run off with the money. He actually trusts her to make this bed, and if it pays off, to get that money back to her. So, I mean, I'm just confused with that character. She does it really, really well, but I don't understand her undying love of him.
Don't either.
What these side hustles are and why she's even working in the store at all.
Yeah, I didn't get that either. That's one thing that maybe another viewing in the future I'll understand what her thing is, but maybe that's just the way it is where you just like sometimes there are things you just don't understand and that's sort of what she is, but I didn't get it. I didn't get, like, especially after he like tells her to leave the apartment, never come back, don't want to see you, all that. And then she just comes back and is like stronger than ever.
Gets the tattoo after that
shit.
And this is not a funny movie, but the funniest line in the fucking movie is right there where she gets a tattoo, he's beaten down and crying, and he's like, oh, now we can't even be buried at the same cemetery.
Yeah.
I assume she's Jewish too.
Yeah.
By the way, the Jewishness of this movie, I thought was the coolest thing about this movie. Mm. Because it pulls no punches of, this is the Jewish part of New York City. We're going to show you an entire Passover Seder, like what happens and that kind of thing. And that was very, very cool to me.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
see something just kind of revel in its culture and to show sides. Like, I've never been to a Passover. I've been to a bat mitzvah, but I've never been to a Passover Seder or anything like that. I thought that was very, very cool.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you're right. It is the one moment that the movie breathes for a second.
Yeah.
And everything. And I think they try to do that. They try to get this whole New York culture thing, which is always supposed to be like this fast paced, you know, everything's going on at once. How do you keep up with it? Well, you're born into it essentially because you're a New Yorker, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. But, and it's interesting. I've never spent any time on 47th Street. It's West, I think, right? Or is it East 47th Street? Where this is that Jeweler's Row type of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting that they show us all the dirty, gross stuff on the back when, you know, tourists or whoever's buying never sees any of that stuff. All they see is the glittering jewelry in the cases, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And but this is the story of how that shit gets done. Like, people, you know, borrowing and lending and interest and all that stuff.
Yeah, they just, I mean, if you were to actually go down and sit Howard down and like, if he was able to recall every person he owes and how many different things he's got in different areas paying off something else and everything, how many like roads would that lead you to?
Who knows?
I mean, it's gotta be, I mean, I was just kept thinking, like, we're seeing the stuff that's in the movie. How many other things are out there where he's like lent $1,000 here, or like he's got another piece of collateral over there? And like,
no, we don't even know where all those watches went.
No,
like Keith Stanfield.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Who knows, man? Well, but he's also affording a big place in Long Island, a Mercedes, downtown apartment.
Yeah.
Like, rented the space itself. Like, he's spent. He has spent some shit.
Yeah. Was it just me, or was he like, there was a point at the beginning where it felt like he didn't even really sell anything out of his store.
That's implied, right? Because he brings out the Furby and everybody's like, oh, that's cool. But then Lakeith Stanfield's character is just like, what the fuck are you going to sell this guy? I bring Kevin Garnett in here.
Yeah.
And you don't have anything to sell him.
Well,
he's
then,
like trying to push his watches. But yeah, he doesn't really have anything of real value, high level value to sell.
Well, and he's trying to get him to sell Garnett a $16,000 watch.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, no, don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And then he's like, here, that's during in the middle of that thing where he's unwrapping the opal and everything. He's like, I think I'm going to come.
Yeah, that's funny. That's the second funniest part of the movie.
And he comes out later. He doesn't want to sell Garnett that. He doesn't want to sell Garnett the opal. What is he doing?
Well, and Kevin Garnett's got a great line in there where he's like, why'd you even show this to me if you weren't going to sell
exactly.
it to me? He's like, yeah, go look at this. Look at this. And he, you know, that's a cool part of the movie where it shows all the complexities of the gem itself.
Mm-hmm.
Again, why I thought that it may actually be worth around what he was saying, because
It
really does linger on how unique this whole thing looks. But no, apparently the mineralogist or whatever.
I did like Garnett's reaction. Well, they had to sort of like what Garnett saw in the opal as he picked it up, like he saw himself in this, like, you know, this big. It was like it was obviously going to give him power of some sort.
Yeah.
You know, like he saw himself in the opal. You know,
he's even in there in the locker room at halftime, like looking at it, like praying to him.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, like as soon as he gives it back, the next game he's like got a shitty game
that.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a sports movie, by the way?
It feels like a sports betting movie type of, I mean, in the end, it kind of feels that way.
It's being reviewed as such. I see it on all like the, you know, the sports
is
culture
this, okay,
sites.
So this, if people call this like straight up a sports movie, like some people want to call Die Hard a Christmas movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I'm going to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
To me, sports movie is your main characters play sports and they have to win or they have to do something in their life as an athlete. That's a sports movie to me. Christmas movie, same way. Is there something about Christmas in this where, it requires Christmas, and you know they're getting gifts, and it's home for the holidays, all that. That's a Christmas movie to me. Like, just because it's, you know, Christmas doesn't mean, just because there's sports doesn't make this a sports movie.
I don't know how you'd categorize this movie,
but sports betting I could get on board with, because a lot of it has to do with that, and it has very little to do with you know, uncut gems or
that's,
you know.
That's another thing. I was like, yeah, the gem is almost like a MacGuffin in the sense that it really doesn't have anything to do with the overall plot. It's weird that he even returns it, because I thought the whole thing was going to be about his quest to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Lakeith Stanfield's character is blowing him off. He's like, you know, I got it. We're 50 miles away, or, you know, no, that kind of thing.
Never any explanation for that. That's another thing that sort of rides your anxiety during this thing.
Yeah,
is that people have motivations you never quite can grasp, and you don't know where they are in the movie. There's a whole point where Lakeith Stanfield's like, I don't really want to go to this weekend show or whatever. Then he's at the weekend show and he's telling Howard, I'm here for the weekend show, man.
Yeah.
Like it was the most natural thing in the world for him to be there smoking, all this stuff. Yeah. And, you know, like and you're just like, where is this guy coming from, man?
Yeah.
I don't understand it. And it just raises that anxiety level so high when you see that type of stuff.
Yeah. The IMDb has it under crime, drama, and mystery.
I don't know if you know what's the mystery.
What's the mystery? There's no mystery.
It's not really a mystery. No. But
it's a crime drama.
Yeah. I mean, Uncut Gems could also be symbolic in some way about characters and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's an uncut gem, although is he a gem, though? Is he really a gem?
No, he's not a gem.
He's not a gem.
I don't like this motherfucker.
Yeah, he's a dick.
I don't like him.
He's a dick. He's a real super dick.
He really is. And this is what people are saying, is that, like, he anchors that because of his charm. And Adam Sandler certainly has charm. He's able to sell movies that are not good just based on his personality alone. He's a very good comedian. Great in Punch Drunk Love. But I didn't get that from him. Great performance, not charismatic at all.
This was apparently supposed to be Jonah Hill at one time, the Howard character. Now, can you imagine Jonah Hill? I can imagine Jonah Hill in this role.
I totally could, like the Wolf of Wall Street type of.
But I'm trying to wonder if I would actually hate it with Jonah Hill in it, because Jonah Hill has played these kind of dicks before, and he always comes off as somebody that I want to be ended.
Yeah,
you know, whereas that's Sandler true. Just pulls off a little bit better for some reason.
That's
I don't
true.
Know.
That's true.
I don't know which one out of those two guys is actually a better actor, but I feel like if Jonah Hill was in the Jonah Hill would have probably taken it places.
Yeah. that would have been very hard to watch, for sure.
Yeah, so I loved it. Barrett hated it. What do you guys think of this movie? Go to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We also have a CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter. That's where Barrett is.
That's right.
Music Video Sins Twitter.
That's where I am.
And we're also on SoundCloud. We also have a Discord. If you want to go to Discord, we have a link on the right side of our Reddit page. You can also go to the Facebook page and private message me, and I will give you an invite to Discord as well. So, that'll do it for this mini pod.
Mini pod, Jimsy pod.
Yeah, Jimsy pod. It's Chris Atkins and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit cinemasins.com.
What's crazy is we went on date night. It was the opening night, and at the theater. There's those theaters where there's the two seats in the back in some of them, and so we got the two seats in the back, little box seat for date night and everything. And I was like, this is cool. And then all of a sudden, like right before the movie starts, this couple walks up right below us, and it's my like best friend John Miller.
Oh, really?
And his mom.
Really?
And I'm like, he's like, is that John? I was like, yeah, that's insane that he would pick this movie at this time, like in this theater. You know, what are the odds? It's like, I don't know if this ever happened to you in New York, but there was a time when I was going to work and I picked the Red Line just randomly picked it up, whatever, on the way to work at like 6:45 a.m. And like one of my closest coworkers was also not only in the car, not only at the same time, but he was right next to me the entire ride.
And didn't know.
Didn't know until we got off. I looked up. I was like, hey, Dan, I've been riding from the exact same spot the entire time.
Yeah. I never really ran into people I knew on the subways and stuff. I think everybody sort of had different, just everybody has a different kind of thing. Like I lived in a completely different area than other people did because, of course, when I moved to New York, I had no idea what to get, what I would needed to get into and everything. I picked a place to, you know, to pay rent at that I thought, oh, well, this is close to the theater. And it was, but it wasn't like for a New Yorker, it wasn't. As buses and subways didn't really go by these areas. You had to do a lot of walking. You had to do a lot of stuff. I had my car for a while too. Yeah. But like when I was on subways and stuff, like, you know, when it was time to go watch movies, like I was really, I felt like I was the only movie buff that was at my theater.
Yeah.
Like everybody else was there as their job. And so I didn't really like invite people out and everything. So it was like, I would get up and take all these buses and subways to Manhattan and everything. And when it was time to go to work, I'm coming from a completely different place. So there's like very few people I could actually run into on their way to work.
But Queens is super small. It's just one neighborhood, right?
Yeah, it's just one neighborhood.
Is indeed pleasing to me. It pleases me. I have derived pleasure.